journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, August 28th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
What activists have planned for the streets of Minneapolis next week outside the RNC? A follow-up report from FSRN's Aura Bogado in Denver as the DNC begins wrapping up, and the third anniversary of Katrina commemorated here in Los Angeles.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Frenzied media coverage of the major party conventions has all but submerged the upcoming third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. The tragedy that resulted in at least 1,600 dead and hundreds of thousands displaced is being marked by community organizations across the country, from New York to Los Angeles and, of course, New Orleans. Nearly 3 years later, injustices abound. Tens of thousands of homes are unoccupied and rents have risen by nearly 50%. According to a study by PolicyLink, 81% of those who received the federally funded state-administered road home grants had insufficient resources to cover their damages. Racial disparities are also prevalent. African-American households on average had an almost 35% higher shortfall in funds for rebuilding than white households. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll, 70% of New Orleans residents feel divided by class and/or race. Today, we hear from local organizers who are putting together a series of events right here in Los Angeles that includes a candlelight vigil, art, food, theater, speakers, live music, and film. Furthermore, the organizers are attempting to connect the struggles of people in New Orleans and here in Los Angeles. My guests are Telmi Perez and David Corona. They're both organizers with SAGE. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, why Los Angeles and New Orleans? What are the connections that the two of you see in your minds?
So as of now, Sonali, what I think a bunch of different regions here in the nation have been working on is we're seeing mass displacement of working-class neighborhoods in all of our major cities, displacement that we've never really seen since urban renewal when it was used against folks of color to remove us from certain parts of the city.
Because of the housing crisis.
Because of the housing crisis.
Which has hit us very hard here in L.A.
Which has hit us extremely hard here in L.A. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to get together with different base-building organizations who have base membership who are filling these extreme conditions. And so what we're trying to do is, one, we're not trying to take away what had happened in Katrina. That was a storm, that was a hurricane, but along with some of the stuff that had happened afterwards, we see some of that in our cities now, and we can kind of compare what's not being done for the very folks who are living in these cities or have lived in these cities. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring together, one, not only remembering what happened in Katrina and what's happening still now, as you brought up, what PolicyLink has been investigating and organizations such as Safe Streets that we're working with out in New Orleans. But what we're also trying to do is we're trying to make the connection, too, that here in L.A., in cities like Miami and cities like New York, you're seeing mass displacement. Here in the city of L.A., you get about 90,000 evictions countywide, but these are legal evictions that go to court. We're not talking about the other outnumbered folks who don't have lawyers, who can't go and are getting evicted. So we're having mass displacement in our cities too. Since the housing crisis, the land has gone up. A lot of folks are really either selling land to developers or trying to figure out how to make more bang for their buck. And so we're trying to bring a nexus and trying to build some sort of solidarity around the issues of displacement as we see them all around the city and all around the nation.
Hmm. Tell me, what are some of the groups on the ground in New Orleans that you're working with, and what are they describing about their situation? Because the real tragedy, many say, is what happened after Katrina.
So we've been working pretty closely with Safe Streets, Strong Communities, and the name basically says it all, right? It's a group of folks that are working on the ground trying to create a safer city, right? Because what we've seen is that a lot of so New Orleans budget is now 500% more than it was before the storm. But a lot of that money is being funneled to policing of the citizens in New Orleans.
And that doesn't make the streets safer?
It doesn't make the streets safer. Actually, it's making the streets less safe because mostly they're policing the black community, I would say. And this is what folks are saying on the ground in New Orleans. So they're basically working to bring some awareness about, you know, how to protect themselves, to bring families into the movement, to start, you know, to basically protect their rights. So we are going to have a representative at our event on Friday, and from Safe Street Strong Communities, and he's working actually at an elementary school there called Gregory Elementary, and there's about 500 students. He's a family educator, so he's working with families to try to build some of that community, right, that's really needed in order to put up a wall of resistance against some of the policing of the communities there, and particularly the African American community. And basically what he's telling me that's going on is that they're having a really hard time rebuilding, that even the school, an elementary school of 500 people, of 500 students, they're housed in 8 trailers. Hmm.
I was reading yesterday that one story that has really gone unreported, except for this one article that I saw, is that a lot of the folks in New Orleans who were trying to survive the aftermath of Katrina and trying to apply for the few government grants that were there were grappling with the issue of illiteracy. 40% of people in the area cannot read or write. These are adults, which points to the very dismal education system, and they have to sift through 12 or 18 documents. Lots of legalese, and many have just been unable to get these grants because it's, you know, even people who are lawyers who looked at these documents had a hard time understanding what they meant.
No, that's true, Sonali. This is Davin. No, that is right. Literacy rates, although we're not from New Orleans, we do here are somewhat similar than what we see here in our city, too, because we have really high, we work in South Central LA, really high illiteracy rates. We're talking about different communities, and we all know where we all come from, and we know that formal education hasn't been the greatest thing for folks of color. So, yes, no, that is right. So imagine folks having to go and decipher through all these documents on top of everything else of just the stress of not knowing where you're going to be or being stable. So, this is the very issue, and this is that we're trying to make comparisons between what's going on in New Orleans and everywhere else in the city, even though there is a contrast, of course. However, what's happening in the rebuilding of the city isn't rebuilding for the very folks who are there, and we're seeing that in every city. As you see, City of L.A. just built 10,000 units of housing, but they were all for folks making $130,000 or more. We have never built that much housing, but where is this housing going to?
So, like in New Orleans, there is housing that's unoccupied. It's just inaccessible.
It's inaccessible. And I know, like New Orleans, the big contrast is they're now dealing with a whole big new slate, right? It's all empty. It's really lots of homes demolished, land that the developers are really, I think, really looking for.
Exploiting.
Exactly. And so some of the things like that are happening here, but they're happening at a mass scale in New Orleans. Mm. And we have to bring attention to this, because if it's happening there, that's the same trend, same neoliberal trends that we're going to be seen in our cities, and that we're seeing in our cities. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to say is a right to the city national alliance is that every working person has a right to live in their city. If this is where all government funding is going, if this is where all resources are going, and if you've lived there, you should have the right to stay there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's not what's happening.
You tell me, the news coverage when Katrina hit was better than average because people were seeing the drama unfolding and seeing the injustices before their eyes, but what has happened in the aftermath, and particularly what is also happening where there are no storms, like in cities like LA, has really gone ignored by the mainstream media. I mean, this is invisible. And of course, the linkages between what's happening in New Orleans and Los Angeles and other cities is really being missed by the mainstream media. How do you and your organization propose to raise these issues to a mass audience?
So what we're doing is on Friday, this Friday is the 3rd anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, as we all know, right? And the Right to the City Alliance is actually staging over 12 different actions across the country, right, to really talk about, to start to see those linkages with our bases, and also to bring attention to what's happening in New Orleans, to put a spotlight on how in New Orleans we're seeing that only one of three rental units in the metropolitan area of New Orleans are being slated, even are being funded to be rebuilt or repaired, right? According to the Policy Link report that's just come out, only 2,600 rental units are open for occupancy of the 25,000 that are slated for recovery and for repair.
Let's talk a little bit about how Katrina is being commemorated across the country. I mean, in New Orleans, the news, if you look for what's being done for Katrina's third anniversary, is this frenzied attempt to build a mausoleum to commemorate the dead and missing, in particular those unclaimed people, and they're trying desperately to finish it by this Friday. You would think 3 years would be enough time to finish such a monument, but it seems as though the folks who are really bothering to commemorate this are local community organizations throughout the country like yours. I mean, across the country, I'm looking at a long list of events for this week mostly. Davin, can you comment on this, you know, the fact that it's mostly local organizations, mm-hmm. and also talk about what's being planned tomorrow here in LA by your group?
So as in regard to the local organization, Sonali, this is the Right to the City Alliance that's been forming. It started back in 06 of January. Actually, the first meeting was here in Little Tokyo, where folks, base-building organizations who haven't been part of the status quo, have been trying to build and build their cities and build a membership of folks of resistance that can say, you know, we have a right to live in the city. And we've been doing this. Unfortunately, we know that these issues are at a broad scale. It's neoliberal policies we're talking about. They're global. They're international. And we knew that in order for us to really start making and really start making a splash, we had to really start getting these groups together and these voices together in order to make a broader alliance. So that's what we're doing. And so each organization from each region, I think we have about six different regions, from Miami to New York to Connecticut to Virginia, up in the Bay. They're all trying to figure out how, since we also have, and folks in New Orleans, I'm sorry, too, we have a region out there. How do we bring light to displacement, the right to live in the city, along with the issue of Katrina that still hasn't been rectified? Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to bring this up, knowing that it's not in the mainstream media. It isn't something our politicians are talking about. Antonio's out right now as we speak at the DNC, but I'm pretty sure.
Yes,
our mayor.
but
as you can tell, these are issues that are not being talked about. And so we're trying
and
to...
And not being talked about at the conventions, really.
Yes, these are bread and butter issues for people. These are the issues that, yes, we talk about the economy, but what does that mean in the details? It means housing. It means jobs. It means the right to transport from one place to another. And none of folks right now are really not having that right anymore. You're now basically having the right just to fight for whatever house rental unit you have. And even that's being taken away with this Proposition 98 that was going to be passed by landlords, where they wanted to eliminate rent control. And you're seeing that in different cities that we're working with. We're in Boston. We're working with Vida Urbana in Boston, who they lost rent control in that manner. And so now they're trying to get it back. And so you're seeing all of these different protections that folks of color, working class communities have, being taken away little by little, while our governments are being defunded too in programs.
But here in California, Prop 98 was beaten and seen as a major victory by many folks. Tell me, let's talk about what's happening tomorrow. What are you and other local organizations, as a coalition of groups here in LA, that have come together? It sounds like a very multifaceted event.
Actually, yeah, we're really excited. We have a good group of organizations here in our region in Los Angeles. So the Right to the City Los Angeles has made it a priority to really put some effort into bringing light to some of those, to what's happening in New Orleans after the storm, and also what's happening in Los Angeles. So SAGE, along with East Los Angeles Community Corporation, along with the Koreatown Immigrant Worker Center, along with Esperanza Community Housing Corporation, along with Union de Vecinos, they're really amazing organizations that have been working to bring together our bases, right, and which are really multicultural bases. So we're bringing together folks from South LA, from East LA, from Koreatown, from across the city, really, in a multicultural evening of solidarity with Hurricane Katrina survivors, and also with folks that are displaced, right, folks that still haven't been able to come back to their city.
So that's happening tomorrow, August 29th at 6:30 p.m. at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. Of course, our listeners are quite familiar with that location. Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. I understand there's also going to be an excerpt of the film we featured on Uprising last week, Trouble the Water, a wonderful film about Katrina, featuring footage taken by two people who survived the storm. Mm-hmm. Again, that is tomorrow, Friday, August 29th, 6:30 p.m., 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. There's going to be food and theater and music and film. So lots of stuff, and also people can find out about your campaign.
Yeah, and I also want to say that we have someone that's flying in from New Orleans mm-hmm. this evening. So Roger's young blood will be here this evening, and he's going to be here for our event, speaking to his experience and what it is, what it feels like on the ground in New Orleans, and what it feels like to be, you know, someone that's trying to survive in a city that's basically taking away our rights.
Well, tell me, Perez and Davin Corona, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Tell me and Davin are organizers with SAGE, which has a website at sage.net, SAGE.net, and you can find out more information about the event tomorrow happening at SAGE.net. Bill Quigley is a human rights lawyer, a law professor at Loyola University New Orleans, and author of the forthcoming book Storms Still Raging, Katrina, New Orleans, and Social Justice. Earlier this week, he published a series of staggering statistics called Katrina Pain Index, New Orleans, 3 years later. Now we present an audio version of these statistics read by our very own Teddy Robinson and Donna Walker of KPFK.
Zero. Number of renters in Louisiana who have received financial assistance from the $10 billion federal Post-Katrina Rebuilding Program Road Home Community Development Block Grant, compared to 116,708 homeowners.
Zero. Number of apartments currently being built to replace the 963 public housing apartments formerly occupied and now demolished at the St. Bernard Housing Development.
Zero. Amount of data available to evaluate performance of publicly financed private-run charter schools in New Orleans in 2005 to 2006 and 2006 to 2007 school years.
0.008 percentage of the rental homes that were supposed to be repaired and occupied by August 2008, which were actually completed and occupied. A total of 82 finished out of 10,000 projected.
1. Rank of New Orleans among U.S. cities in percentage of housing vacant or ruined.
1. Rank of New Orleans among U.S. cities in murder per capita for 2006 and 2007.
4. Number of the 13 City of New Orleans planning districts that are at the same risk of flooding as they were before Katrina.
10. Number of apartments being rehabbed so far to replace the 896 apartments formerly occupied and now demolished at the Lafayette Housing Development.
11. Percent of families who have returned to live in the Lower Ninth Ward.
17. Percentage increase in wages in the hotel and food industry since before Katrina.
20 to 25. Years that experts estimate it will take to rebuild the city of New Orleans at current pace.
25. Percent fewer hospitals in Metro New Orleans than before Katrina.
32. Percent of the city's neighborhoods that have fewer than half as many households as they did before Katrina.
36. Percent fewer tons of cargo that move through the port of New Orleans since Katrina.
38. Percent fewer hospital beds in New Orleans since Katrina.
40. Percentage fewer special education students attending publicly funded, privately run charter schools than traditional public schools.
41. Number of publicly funded, privately run public charter schools in New Orleans out of total of 79 public schools in the city.
43. Percentage of child care available in New Orleans compared to before Katrina.
46. Percentage increase in rents in New Orleans since Katrina.
56. Percentage fewer inpatient psychiatric beds than before Katrina.
80. Percentage fewer public transportation buses now than pre-Katrina.
81. Percentage of homeowners in New Orleans who received insufficient funds to cover the complete costs to repair their homes.
300. Number of National Guard troops still in the city of New Orleans.
1,080. Today's National Guard troops have remained in City of New Orleans.
1,250. Number of publicly financed vouchers for children to attend private schools in New Orleans in program's first year.
6,982. Number of families still living in FEMA trailers in Metro New Orleans area.
8,000. Fewer publicly assisted rental apartments planned for New Orleans by federal government.
10,000. houses demolished in New Orleans since Katrina.
12,000, number of homeless in New Orleans even after camps of people living under bridge have been resettled, double the pre-Katrina number.
14,000, number of displaced families in New Orleans area whose hurricane rental assistance expires March 2009.
32,000, number of children who have not returned to public school in New Orleans, leaving the public school population less than half what it was pre-Katrina.
39,000. Number of Louisiana homeowners who have applied for federal assistance in repair and rebuilding who have still not received any money.
45,000. Fewer children enrolled in Medicaid public health care in New Orleans than pre-Katrina.
46,000. Fewer African American voters in New Orleans in 2007 gubernatorial election than 2003 gubernatorial election.
55,000. Fewer houses receiving mail than before Katrina.
62,000. Fewer people in New Orleans enrolled in Medicaid public health care than pre-Katrina.
71,657. Vacant, ruined, unoccupied houses in New Orleans today.
124,000. Fewer people working in metropolitan New Orleans than pre-Katrina.
132,000. Fewer people in New Orleans than before Katrina, according to the City of New Orleans' current population estimate of 321,000 in New Orleans.
214,000. Fewer people in New Orleans than before Katrina, according to the U.S. Census Bureau current population estimate of 239,000 in New Orleans.
453,726. Population of New Orleans before Katrina.
320 million. The number of trees destroyed in Louisiana and Mississippi by Katrina.
368 million. Dollar losses of five major Metro New Orleans hospitals from Katrina through 2007. In 2008, these hospitals expect another $103 million in losses.
$1.9 billion FEMA dollars scheduled to be available to Metro New Orleans for Katrina damages that have not yet been delivered.
$2.6 billion FEMA dollars scheduled to be available to State of Louisiana for Katrina damages that have not yet been delivered.
Donna Walker and Teddy Robinson reading the Katrina Pain Index, New Orleans 3 years later, written by Bill Quigley. Music by Terrence Blanchard from the soundtrack to When the Levees Broke. You are listening to Uprising. After today's subversive historian, we'll find out how activists are gearing up for the Republican National Convention. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. 53 years ago on this day in people's history, a young African-American teen named Emmett Till was brutally murdered. On August 28, 1955, the young 14-year-old was kidnapped from his uncle's home in Money, Mississippi to be beaten, shot, and killed. Days earlier, Till, who was visiting from Chicago, walked into the local grocery store of a white couple named Carolyn and Roy Bryant. Conflicting accounts say that Till either whistled or said bye, baby, to Carolyn. News spread, and alongside others, Roy Bryant and his half-brother murdered Till, tied a 75-pound cotton gin fan around the boy's neck with a barbed wire, and dumped his body into the Tallahatchie River. The main suspects in the murder were acquitted, but later confessed for $4,000. Emmett Till's mother bravely fought to have an open casket funeral so that all could see what race hatred had done to her son. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
As St. Paul prepares for the Republican National Convention starting this Monday, the corporate media has focused primarily on the presumptive presidential nominees and their proclaimed agendas. But those demonstrating in the streets outside the major party conventions hope to influence those agendas. CNN estimates that tens of thousands of people will converge into St. Paul next week. Among them are groups against the Iraq War and those calling for government funding for more productive and just endeavors, including welfare. Events include a life-size replica of a Guantanamo maximum security cell, bike and rollerblade brigades, and a satirical Support Our Oil Companies party. But while the activists have been organizing, police have concurrently prepared for their arrival. St. Paul police have constructed temporary detainment areas. They have already handcuffed a former journalist for photographing police and detained three journalists documenting police protester interactions. The police confiscated their cameras, computers, and notes without providing a receipt, explained one of those arrested, quote, "What they took away was our ability to report." The ACLU of Minnesota anticipates 800 arrests in the coming week and will have 75 lawyers available for their defense. Joining us on the line this morning from Minneapolis and St. Paul are Deb Konechny with the Welfare Rights Committee and Wes Davey with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. Welcome to Uprising, Deb, and we're trying to get Wes on still. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
So first, let's talk about the Welfare Rights Committee and what you have organized for the Republican National Convention. What are the main issues that you're trying to raise at the RNC?
Well, the Welfare Rights Committee is actually one organization in a large coalition that developed around responding to the Republican National Convention, which is the coalition to march on the RNC and stop the war. And the coalition as a whole is going to be bringing the issue of the war to the Convention of the War Makers at the Excel Center in St. Paul on September 1st. There will be a massive national march. There are 125 organizations who have signed on to the call and on to the protest, and we have organizing centers organizing around the country that will be bringing individuals that want to speak out and protest the war to the Republican National Convention.
I want to bring Wes Davey onto the phone. Wes, you are with Iraq Veterans Against the War, a group that has been a little bit in the news, although not enough, I would say, because of what happened yesterday in Denver at the Democratic National Convention. IVAW led the largest anti-war march of the week, and your colleagues managed to get a meeting with an Obama representative. We'll be talking about that in the next story from Denver. But first, tell us what you are planning at the Republican National Convention. Anything similar, or are you escalating your tactics in Minneapolis?
Well, first, thanks for inviting me. Actually, we're going to be not doing quite as much. We're aware that if we go to Senator McCain and ask him to end the war like they did in Denver, that we're going to get no response whatsoever. So we're going to just stick to one of our other IVAW goals, the Iraq Veterans Against the War goals, and that's better treatment for returning veterans when they come home from war. So we plan on presenting a list of issues that we'd like to see Senator McCain address, either as a senator or if he gets elected as president. And we feel those issues are very important for those returning veterans, so we want to make sure that he's aware of them.
And Wes, what has McCain's record been? You know, he is someone who uses his record in the Vietnam War very extensively to campaign when campaigning for president and as senator. It's you can't, you know, even say the name McCain without reminding us constantly that he was in a POW camp and tortured, et cetera. What has his position been on veterans' rights?
Well, you know, I don't have a real strong knowledge of what he's done on veterans' rights, but he has voted with Bush 95% of the time. And just in the past several months, the GI Bill for the 21st century came up for consideration by the House and the Senate, and Senator McCain stood strongly against it. It did pass, and he eventually, you know, said it was a good thing, but at the time, he opposed it. So, you know, we don't like that he did that, and we'd like to see him be stronger for veterans' rights.
Deb, what is the connection that you are making and your group is making between welfare and war?
The connection we're making is that we see that there's a huge connection between the war that's being waged on poor and working people in Iraq and the war that's being waged on poor and working people in this country. So we're trying to show that connection exists, that there is a war going on against the poor here as well, as far as cuts in the social safety net, cuts in social programs, that all of the billions and billions of dollars being spent to kill and devastate people in Iraq is money that is not being used for human needs in the United States. And so we are having a large, massive poor people's contingent within the anti-war march that will say that we want money to be used for human needs, not for war.
What do you make of the police preparations? The St. Paul Police Department is, it seems, gearing up for mass arrests already.
Well, I happen to live in St. Paul, and I know that the St. Paul police do a very good job. And what I'm concerned about is all the other law enforcement agencies that come in that will be here for the RNC. And who knows what they're going to be like. I mean, you've got the National Guard, you've got all other kinds of police and sheriff's deputies and other law enforcement agents coming in. And, you know, how they're going to respond to the protest, I have no idea. If it was just the St. Paul police, I know that they'd, you know, they do a good job. They are very professional, but that's people I'm concerned about.
Deb, what do you think, and what do you make of the preparations?
Well, you know, we've been, as part of the coalition, we've been engaged in constant negotiations with the city and the police department for almost a year because we waged a lawsuit over the permit for the march. And so all along they have said, no, you know, the entire city of St. Paul will be a free speech area, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, we have a permit, and we believe it's because of the battle that we carried on at a grassroots level and a legal level for all this time. We do have a permit for the march on the opening day, September 1st, that will take us directly across from the Excel Center. It's not the permit we originally wanted, but it is a permit, and we do have that space. So the march on September 1st is a safe and legal place for families, elders, everyone to bring their family members, children, et cetera, to be a part of this massive, historic march on September 1st.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I'm looking at an article in the Star Tribune which compared the free, quote-unquote, free speech areas in Denver versus in St. Paul. In Denver, protesters had 50,000 square feet set up for them compared with 180,000 square feet in St. Paul. Denver, the viewing area was 780 feet from the convention site, but in St. Paul, much closer, only about 84 feet. That's interesting. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's definitely because of the ongoing grassroots pressure. Really, once the Republicans announced they were holding their convention in St. Paul, the activists in the Twin Cities started putting in for permits, which was 2 years ago.
And the ACLU has also filed some lawsuits, right?
The ACLU, mm-hmm. the National Lawyers Guild, we were involved in a very heated battle with lawsuits to secure a permit that would take us directly to the Excel Center. Again, we didn't get the exact permit that we wanted, but we do feel that the access that we are going to have is because of the ongoing grassroots pressure and legal pressure that has been brought on the city by those of us who want to speak out against the war both at home and abroad.
Wes Davey, you're with IBAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. You know, the Republican Party usually pays a lot of lip service to supporting the troops, and you know, you're going to be facing a lot of Republicans in the Twin Cities next week. Do you think that they're going to listen to what you have to say? Do you think that the media that's going to gather there, the major media that's going to gather there, is going to pay attention to the fact that there are going to be a lot of veterans trying to make their voice heard?
Well, I think the media will listen to us. You know,
they ignored Winter Soldier hearings, completely ignored it.
But the media from all over the world is going to be here for the RNC. So, you know, we have a press conference scheduled for Monday afternoon after the march on the RNC. And the major media, you know, I think they're going to do a good job of covering the vets. I would hope they would. I mean, Winter Soldier out in Washington, D.C. was kind of isolated, and, you know, maybe they didn't have the means to cover that, but everyone's going to be here, so I think we're going to get the attention that we need to focus on the issues of the veterans. And, you know, have the Republicans done a good job as far as, you know, veterans issues? You know, absolutely not. And but to be honest with you, I don't think the Democrats have done much better job than the Republicans have. It's
certainly
kind of been neglected, and so that's why we want to address, you know, attention to those issues.
Finally, Deb, where can listeners find out more information about the coalition that you're a part of?
Individuals can go to www.marchontherNC.org and or welfarerightsmn.org. Those are two websites sites that are available. Also, there is a Protest RNC 2008 website that lists a number of activities going on. And I know that the Veterans Against the War will be the first contingent in the march on September 1st, so they will be front and center. And our Poor People's Contingent will be close behind, so all of these issues will be out there on that day.
And IVAW's website is ivaw.org. Deb Konechny and Wes Davey, thank you both so much for joining us today, and best of luck next week.
Thank you so much.
Again, those websites that Deb mentioned, welfarerightsmn.org, marchontherNC.org, and protestrnc2008.org. IVAW site is ivaw.org. You are listening to Uprising. And by the way, Pacifica Radio has been doing live national coverage of the conventions this week. Again, from 5 to 9 p.m., you can hear Barack Obama's acceptance speech as well as the analysis by Pacifica hosts tonight, as we have done every night this week. And next week, we will, of course, be broadcasting live from the RNC as well. I'll be one of the anchors for that broadcast. And we will be having a couple of Uprising programs live from the Twin Cities as well. Very excited about that. So stay tuned for all of that. After this short break, we'll go live to Denver with my colleague, Aro Bogado.
In the 1990s, a loose-knit group of like-minded outsiders found common ground in a little New York City storefront gallery. Rooted in the DIY, do-it-yourself subcultures of skateboarding, surf, hip-hop, and graffiti, they made art that reflected the lifestyles they led. Developing their craft with almost no influence from the, quote, establishment art world, this group and the subcultures they sprang from have now become a movement that has been transforming pop culture. Starring 11 artists who are considered leaders within this culture, including Shepard Fairey and Harmony Korine, director Aaron Rose's documentary, Beautiful Losers, focuses on the telling of personal stories, speaking to themes of what happens when the outside becomes in, as it explores the creative ethos connecting these artists and today's youth. With original music by Money Mark, Beautiful Losers opens for a week's DIY at the New Art on Friday, August 29th, and Film Club members know how to do it themselves with a little help from the station's switchboard.
Welcome back to Uprising. On day three of the Denver DNC, former President Bill Clinton addressed delegates. Barack Obama's running mate Joe Biden accepted the vice presidential nomination, and Obama himself made a surprise appearance.
Barack Obama will lead us away from the division and fear of the last 8 years, back to unity and hope. So, if, like me, you believe America must always be a place called hope, then join Hillary and Chelsea and me in making Barack Obama the next president of the United States. Thank you, and God bless you.
John thinks that during the Bush years, quote, we've made great economic progress. I think it's been abysmal. And in the Senate, John has voted with President Bush 95%, and that is very hard to believe. And when John McCain proposes $200 million in new taxes for corporate America, $1 billion alone for the largest companies in the nation, but no relief for 100 million American families, that's not change. That's more of the same.
Hello, Democrats! I just wanted to come out here for a little something to say. I want everybody to now understand why I am so proud to have Joe Biden and Jill Biden and Bo Biden and Mama Biden and the whole Biden family with me on this journey to take America back.
The voices of Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, and Barack Obama, respectively, at the Pepsi Hall in Denver yesterday. Meanwhile, outside the convention hall, Rage Against the Machine played to a crowd of thousands, followed by the largest demonstration of the week, an anti-war march led by Iraq Veterans Against the War. IVAW members in Denver demanded to meet with the Obama campaign and deliver a letter containing their demands to end the war and support veterans. They were met by 100 Denver police clad in riot gear and armed with batons and tear gas. Eventually, one member of IBAW was allowed to cross the police line to meet with a representative of the Obama campaign. Major U.S. news media chose to almost completely ignore this dramatic story, but Aura Bogado was there, anchor for Free Speech Radio News. She's covering both conventions for Pacifica Radio. She's also blogging from inside and outside the conventions at tothecurb.wordpress.com, and she joins us once more this week to tell us what's been happening in Denver. Welcome back, Aura.
Good morning, Sonali.
So first, very briefly, let's get your comments on what happened inside the convention hall. I played little clips of Bill Clinton and Joe Biden and Barack Obama's surprise appearance. How did delegates inside the halls react to these speeches and Barack Obama's surprise appearance?
Well, it probably wasn't that much of a surprise to the people inside the convention. There was a lot of chatter about that. I ran back in from the IVAW march outside to try and file something, and by the time I walked in, everyone was chattering about, we think Obama's here, we think Obama's here. Of course, the big deal for last night was that Joe Biden was on. And he, you know, made an interesting speech. And, yeah.
So let's talk about what happened outside the convention hall. The IVAW march, of course, from here in Los Angeles, the little that we could find out about it through outlets like Democracy Now! And you know, the Guardian newspaper of London, sounded pretty dramatic. The major media ignored it. But what happened in your words? What happened when you were there?
Well, I think that last night's action by Iraq Veterans Against the War was a clear, clear victory. Their demands were very clear. They issued a letter to the Obama campaign calling for full health care and benefits for all returning veterans, the immediate withdrawal of all the troops from Iraq, and reparations for the Iraqi people for anything that was caused by the U.S. invasion. They went back and forth from what's called the Freedom Cage to the other side of the perimeter. They were marching in formation in response and reaction.
And they were wearing uniforms, many of them, right?
Many of them were fully, fully uniformed, yes. Mm-hmm. And there were many times when it got very, very extremely tense. I mean, you could feel how tense it was between the thousands of riot-clad police officers. I mean, I just couldn't count. I really was trying to get an accurate count of how many police officers there were.
Well, the report that I saw said only 100 Denver police.
No, not at all. That's completely inaccurate. I mean, I think I have from the pictures that I took, there's at least 100 pictures of police officers from last night in my pictures alone, and I couldn't get around and photograph all of them, nor did I want to. But there was no less than 1,000 police. All over the place.
I want to play the interview that you did with one IVAW member now at the march. This is Aura Bogado, anchor for Free Speech Radio News. She spoke yesterday at the major march led by Iraq Veterans Against the War to one of the members there.
My name is Sergeant Mathis Shiro. I served in Afghanistan, the Philippines, Germany, Japan, Poland, Italy, and a bunch of other places. I was overseas for more than 4.5 years. Well, I was in the military, actually. So. I'm not a conscientious objector. I would absolutely pick up arms in defense of this nation, but I will not participate in an illegal war of aggression, which is inflicting immeasurable damage, not just upon my brothers and sisters, but the Iraqi people themselves. And I want to apologize to Iraq for the past 5 years of occupation. I want to apologize to the Iraqi people for the damage we've done their country for no good reason. This was an illegal war of aggression. President Bush, in my opinion, defrauded our nation's military might and tricked us all into an illegal, aggressive occupation. Preemptive strikes will not fly any longer unless they are very, 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 very credible. We can stand no more hijacking of the rule of law in the United States, what is supposed to be a shining beacon on a hill, as an example for the rest of the world. We cannot continue to carry on in the manner we have these past 5 years. I am so overjoyed that this action today might have an impact on the direction of this nation. Every single member of Iraq Veterans Against the War is a hero for standing out here today in the face of overwhelming adversity and standing true to our values, standing true to what we know is right, and not betraying ourselves, our experiences, and the truth in the face of potential violence directed at us, a nonviolent organization. What I am very, very happy about is that the march remained completely nonviolent and respectful to the authority here. Iraq Veterans Against the War is absolutely not an anti-authoritarian organization, nor are we anti-military. And I'm overjoyed that our demonstration, our beliefs, could bring people from all across the political spectrum to unify around one central point of justice and peace. Thank you to each and every last member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Thank you to my mother for laboring for more than a day to bring me into this world and supporting me these long 24 years. I love you, Mom. I love my family. I can't wait to see him again. That's all I can do. Thank you.
That's the voice of one member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, interviewed by Aura Bogado, anchor for Free Speech Radio News. She's currently in Denver. She'll be heading to the Twin Cities next week, and she's blogging from inside and outside the conventions at tothecurb.wordpress.com. Aura, a very moving interview. It's interesting, though, the political position of this particular member that you spoke to. How did that play with the other organizations, some of whom are quite radical and to the left of IVAW in Denver?
You know, I think this is something I'm going to be blogging about later today. I've been thinking a lot about 1968, probably the last 2 days I've been thinking a lot about 1932, just in terms of elections and the economy and everything that happens around presidential elections. I was just stunned that this group of veterans, you know, all of them have served. Most of them will say, I need to apologize to the Iraqi people because I have blood on my hands. This group of veterans led about 10,000 people. This guy that I talked to that you just played the clip from, the reason I went up to him to talk to him is because he was taking a picture with some friends he made this week. I asked those young people if they identified as anti-authoritarians, and they said, yes, we're anarchists, we're hardcore anarchists, right? You know, dressed in black, had their faces covered, and they're taking this picture with this guy that's, you know, served in the military, is against this war, he's in full army fatigue. And I say, how does this happen? How, this is very different than during the Vietnam War when people were against the war. And they're like, well, we learned from that. We learned that we can't turn against people that have served overseas and that have those experiences and that want the same peace that we want. And it was really amazing, Molly, to see all these veterans lead, about 100 feet behind them, to lead all these people. You had Democrats. You had people that were not, you know, delegates, but just everyday Democrats from, you know, wearing Obama T-shirts. Two anarchists, you had people from Food Not Bombs, you had medics, you had the National Lawyers Guild, you had, you know, everything that you would see, all the types of folks that you would see at an anti-war march, and they were all being led by Iraq Veterans Against the War. It was pretty stunning.
Aura, you interviewed an Obama delegate, again, here's another political position here, Norman Solomon, very progressive analyst and writer who's, interestingly enough, inside the convention halls. I want to play for our listeners the interview you did with him, but can you set it up for us, who Norman Solomon is and his position inside the convention hall?
Well, Norman Solomon, of course, is the author of War Made Easy. He ran on an anti-war platform to be an Obama delegate, won handsomely in Northern California. And he's basically the one that's talking about 1932, how you had this very right-wing McCain-like Herbert Hoover. And then you had this Democrat, FDR, and the country was, you know, in a state of depression. And what ended up happening after FDR won was we got the New Deal, right? And if we look back on this election too, we'll remember that Hoover had these vehement attacks against Roosevelt, like FDR was some kind of crazy leftist radical. It sort of sounds familiar this week with McCain camp launching this ad linking Bill Avery to Barack Obama. But Norman Solomon's whole point is that we need to start with the grassroots. I sort of feel like this IVAW victory last night is an example of that.
Mm. Aro Bogado, thank you so much for joining us, and I'll see you in the Twin Cities next week.
I'll see you then, Sonali. Thank you.
Thank you. Aro Bogado, anchor for Free Speech Radio News, who's covering both conventions for Pacifica Radio. She's also blogging from inside and outside the conventions at tothecurb.wordpress.com. Here's her interview with Norman Solomon, an Obama delegate, progressive analyst, and writer.
Well, I think it's important to put it in the historical perspective of the Democratic Party. You know, people say, well, look at the Democrats. And I think that that phrase, the Democrats, can often be very misleading. During the Vietnam War, there was Scoop Jackson, known as the senator from Boeing, a hawk for the Vietnam War. And then there was Senator Wayne Morse, who was articulate and emphatic about opposing the war in Vietnam. Now we have Democrats like Rahm Emanuel, who are blue dogs, who are pro-war, who are very kept animals of the corporate state, you might say. And then you have Barbara Lee and Lynn Woolsey and Maxine Waters. They all are called Democrats. So what is the future of the Democratic Party depends in large measure on what kind of organizing we do at the base. Precincts should be places where, because they are about the neighborhoods of our country, the left is able to mobilize effectively. And in a sense, I feel that sometimes as progressives, we kind of scapegoat overly people like, say, Nancy Pelosi. Because we have not been able to organize at the precinct level, we have not won the argument over the proper direction of this country. We have not won the argument among the people of the country, you might say, sufficiently for the need to oppose corporate power, to end the warfare state, to oppose what Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism. We haven't won that argument. Now, granted, there are huge obstacles. Corporate mass media, huge amounts of money, the military-industrial media complex. But we have not been able to successfully persuade most people in this country that a progressive agenda is worth standing fully behind. So, yes, we should oppose the Republicans. Yes, we should oppose blue dog, conservative, centrist, pro-corporate Democrats. But we got a lot of work to do where we live, where we work, where we go to school. And that means grassroots organizing. It ain't easy, but it's really the future for us.
Norman Solomon speaking with Aura Bogado, anchor of Free Speech Radio News. Norman Solomon is a progressive analyst and writer, has written several books, including War Made Easy, and he is currently an Obama delegate. You are listening to Uprising, and for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Ralph Bunche once said, "There are no warlike people, just warlike leaders." That's Ralph Bunche, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. Tune in to Pacifica Radio's national coverage from the last day of the convention tonight from 5 to 9 p.m. You have been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Natalie Yar is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. And by the way, Pacifica's election coverage is also online on a new site called election411.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.